This is Jillian, and you are listening to Episode 10, Part 2 of the Court Junkie podcast. A special thank you to all of you for listening, subscribing, and sharing this podcast. If you like the show, please consider leaving me a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you're listening from. And if you'd like to discuss this case, as well as other court cases, please consider joining our Facebook group. You can go to courtjunkie.com/Facebook or just search for the Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook. In the last episode, I told you about a woman named Christine Bunch. In the early morning hours of June 30th, 1995, 21-year-old Christine was abruptly awoken to smoke filling her mobile home in Decatur County, Indiana. Her house was on fire. Christine was able to escape, but she was unable to get to her 3-year-old son, Tony, who was on the other end of the mobile home. Tony didn't survive, and within hours of the tragedy, investigators were telling Christine that the fire had been intentionally set and that she was their main suspect. She was arrested, and after a short trial, she was convicted of arson and murder. Christine, who had gotten pregnant while out on bail, gave birth to her son Trent while incarcerated. She was desperate to get out and give Trent a normal life, but after her appeal was denied, things weren't looking good. She reached out to numerous attorneys to try and get them to handle her post-conviction relief petition, which was essentially her last shot at freedom. She was finally able to obtain a new attorney, a woman named Hillary Beau Ricks, as well as get help from the Northwestern Center of Wrongful Convictions. We ended the last episode with an offer from the Decatur County prosecutor. In 2009, one of Christine's attorneys visited her at the Indiana Women's Prison and relayed the proposal. They would dramatically reduce her sentence if she confessed to intentionally setting the fire that had killed her son. And if she did, she could get out in 6 years.
I struggled with it, and I cried a lot during that visit, but ultimately, it was my son. I couldn't teach him that it's right to tell a lie to get what you want, and no matter how bad I wanted out, I wasn't going to admit to something I didn't do just to get that.
And as I told you in part one, Christine decided not to take that deal. And now, on to part two. Christine's post-conviction relief petition claimed that the state had failed to disclose certain evidence to the defense, also known as a Brady violation, and it also claimed ineffective assistance of counsel. But perhaps the biggest argument came in the form of newly discovered evidence due to advances in the field of fire science. And it's likely if you've been following court cases for a while that you've heard of this type of thing before, where advances in science, like DNA for example, have turned up evidence that shows that the case may not be as it seemed at the original trial. We saw this with the Central Park Five, for example. If you're not familiar with that case, 5 young men were wrongfully convicted of a brutal rape in New York City's Central Park in 1989. DNA had been in its infancy when their trial took place, so the jury believed that the 5 men had been responsible. However, advances in DNA years later showed that another man was actually responsible, and the Central Park 5 were released from prison. So here Christine's team was, now in 2009, applying for post-conviction relief, and armed with their Brady violation accusation, which I'll go over more in depth in a minute, as well as advances in the fire science field. And Christine's team had grown considerably larger at this point as well. Her attorney, Hillary Beau Ricks, agreed to stay on the case pro bono, and the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Conviction attorneys, Jane Rayleigh and Karen Daniel, took over. They recruited 2 powerful attorneys from Chicago, Ron Safer and Kelly Warner, who also took on the case pro bono. It was a dream team of sorts. But as powerful as her team was, newly discovered evidence isn't as easy to prove as you might think. A new trial based on this is only granted when the defendant demonstrates each of the following 9 requirements. The evidence has been discovered since the trial. It's material and relevant. It's not cumulative. It's not merely impeaching. It's not privileged or incompetent. Due diligence was used to discover it in time for trial. The evidence is worthy of credit. It can be produced upon a retrial of the case. And it will probably produce a different result at retrial. In her petition, Christine made 2 claims of newly discovered evidence that she says entitled her to a new trial. Advances in science regarding fire victim toxicology, and advances in science relating to fire investigation techniques. Christine's evidentiary hearing for post-conviction relief was held in October 2009. Judge Westhafer, her trial judge, would again be presiding. Christine's team presented testimony from 4 experts who testified that advances in fire science would now disprove the state's theory and the evidence that they had presented at trial. They said they could disprove each point of evidence that the Indiana Supreme Court had detailed in their ruling affirming Christine's conviction. The most crucial testimony came from a woman named Jamie McAllister. McAllister's credentials were impressive. She had a bachelor's and master's degree in fire protection engineering, and she was in the process of pursuing a doctorate in toxicology. And not only that, but she had 14 years' experience as a fire investigator, and she had investigated between 200 and 300 fires. McAllister testified that, in her opinion, the fire originated in the concealed space above the south bedroom, in between the ceiling and the roof, and that it was not caused by an accelerant. She came to her conclusions by reviewing the eyewitness testimony about the fire, examining photographs of the damage to the mobile home, and analyzing Tony's toxicology results. She said that the fire started in that space above the ceiling in Tony's bedroom, and that it burned through the ceiling tiles and dropped to the floor, spreading into the living room and throughout the mobile home. McAllister said that Tony's toxicology and autopsy reports showed that his carbon monoxide saturation, which becomes fatal at 50%, was indeed at 80%. He had inhaled smoke and soot, yet there were no burns in his trachea or his lungs, something she said that would be present if he had been in proximity to a fire set right there in his bedroom, as the state had alleged. She said that a fire in an enclosed, unventilated space produces more carbon monoxide than flames in an open area. She said it would have taken at least 90 minutes for Tony's levels to reach that 80% if the fire had been started on the floor in Tony's bedroom or in the living room. But by then, he would have died from burns. And it was undisputed that the fire had only lasted for 30 minutes. So the state's theory of 2 fires having been set with accelerants was just not possible. McAllister also said that Christine's injuries match up to this conclusion as well. She said Christine was likely also exposed to carbon monoxide, which impaired her senses and judgment. Christine's medical records from that day show that she had soot in her respiratory system, indicating that she had inhaled a great amount of smoke. And McAllister said that Christine's blood gases were normal when checked at the hospital, consistent with the conclusion that Christine was not in the room where the fire started. Furthermore, McAllister said that Christine's minor injuries were not consistent with having intentionally started a fire with a liquid accelerant. All of this proves, she said, that an underventilated fire accidentally started in a confined space in the south bedroom. In other words, there was no arson. And why didn't this come out at Christine's trial? Well, considering a fire victim's physiological condition didn't become a recognized aspect of fire origin analysis until after 2001. There's something called the National Fire Protection Association 921 Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, or NFPA 921. The guide is peer-reviewed, and it's a generally accepted standard in the fire investigation community. It's revised approximately every 3 years due to new information and advances in science. But that wasn't all. Christine's team also alleged a Brady violation. One of the things her new attorneys had done when taking on her case was to subpoena those ATF files that the state had produced from the original investigation. And when they received the files, they found that the original test results showed that there had been no heavy petroleum distillate, or HPD, which is an accelerant, found in the bedroom. The results were negative. And not only that, but there was something peculiar about these results. Somebody had made alterations and had crossed out two of the findings that had said negative on them to make it look as though they had been positive. And it just happened to be two of the samples that would have gone along with the state's pouring of accelerant theory. Now, if you'll remember, the state's witness at trial, ATF analyst William Kennard, had testified that there had been traces of an accelerant used. But the negative results listed in the file were completely contradictory to what Kennard had testified to. Kennard had said that the areas in the bedroom and the living room had tested positive for liquid accelerant. However, now we learn that there had been nothing found in the bedroom, and traces of kerosene had only been found in the living room, which Christine's team says that there's an innocent explanation for. The family had a kerosene heater in the living room during the winter, and when they filled it sometimes, the kerosene would spill on the floor. Christine's team argued that the fact that these original results had been withheld from the defense from a state's expert meant that a Brady violation had occurred. And whether or not the prosecutor knew about it was irrelevant, since that expert was part of the state's team. And Christine's team also had an expert, a man named John DeHaan, author of one of the most widely used textbooks about fire investigations, testify at the hearing that he agreed with that original report, that the results for an HPD or accelerant in the bedroom were negative. And just how the original trial seemed to be pretty damning against Christine, this new evidence seemed to be pretty damning against the state. After hearing all the evidence, Judge Westhafer took his time to make his decision, 8 months, in fact. And on June 8th, 2010, he finally made his ruling. Christine's post-conviction relief was denied. So in a crushing blow to Christine's case, the court concluded that she had failed to prove that she had newly discovered evidence. In part, they said that the new experts Christine had presented still said that the cause of the fire was undetermined, which was the same conclusion her expert at trial, Tom Hulse, had reached. Therefore, they said the outcome of the trial would not have been different. The court also ruled that each of the four new expert witnesses had based their conclusions on the same evidence from trial, and that they were merely introducing other interpretations of it. The court said that had the ATF results been given to the defense at the time of the trial, the outcome would have been the same. They also pointed to Christine's conflicting statements and noted that in all of her descriptions, she never described the fire as coming from the ceiling, and therefore, her petition was denied. At this phase of the system, it's always difficult to see a light at the end of the tunnel. You've been convicted, your appeal has been denied, and now your post-conviction relief has been denied too. For those of you who followed Ryan Ferguson's case, or are currently following Melissa Kaluzinski's case, which I covered back in episode 1, this is the same thing that happened to both Ryan and Melissa. Ryan's post-conviction relief was denied, and then it was overturned in the appeals process. And Melissa's post-conviction relief was just denied in September of this year, so her case is making its way through the appeals process right now. And as you can probably guess, it's quite a lengthy process. Christine's team appealed the decision, and a little over a year later, back to court they went. On July 13, 2011, Christine's attorney, Ron Safer, argued the case before a three-member panel of the Court of Appeals of Indiana. Safer again went over the testimony of the new experts, focusing on McAllister's testimony. The judges pointed out that none of the old experts or the new ones could determine what had started the fire, and they questioned why the outcome at a retrial would be different if nobody could say what had caused it. Safer told them that the difference is that this time their experts are world-renowned and that they're looking at new evidence that hadn't been available at the time of Christine's trial. It's based on new science. He said that even though the ultimate outcome of finding that it was undetermined may be the same, the ways in which they arrived at the conclusions were starkly different. He said the fire could not have been intentionally set, as the state contended. And one of the reasons was because Tony had died of smoke inhalation and not from the actual fire. Safer concluded that it was scientifically impossible for the fire to have occurred the way the state believed it did. And he said that there was no other explanation for Tony's death other than the fire had started above him. So another long wait and another 8 months later. But this wait would be worth it. On March 21st, 2012, the court reversed Christine's conviction. How did you get the news that you had won a new trial?
I received phone calls from Jane Rayleigh and Hillary Borix in my counselor's office. They called back to back to tell me that my conviction had been reversed and I was being given a new trial.
Oh my gosh. What do you remember about how you felt at that moment?
I think it's just shock. It takes a minute to grasp it, that everything you've been hoping for and fighting for and praying for just got answered. And you're going to get to tell your truth, and this time people are going to listen.
Two out of the three judges ruled in Christine's favor, saying that she was entitled to a new trial because the evolution of fire science met the legal criteria for new evidence, and also because of those undisclosed ATF results. The judges said that those results directly contradicted William Kennard's trial testimony, that there had been two fires started in two different places. The court said that they disagreed with Judge Westhafer's finding, that the new evidence was just different packaging for the same conclusion. They ruled that McAllister's testimony disproved the state's theory of the fire having been set purposefully in an open room, and that Tony's injuries were not consistent with that type of scenario, and neither were Christine's. The ruling went on to state that the outcome would be different at a retrial. It then went on point by point through the evidence that the state had presented at Christine's trial and countered it, saying that the largely circumstantial evidence at trial did not overwhelmingly prove Christine's guilt. Yes, she was alone with Tony in the trailer when the fire started. Yes, she gave inconsistent statements, but they wrote that she was asked to give two statements on the day of the fire, including one while she was still at the hospital, and that only excerpts of those statements were introduced into evidence. And yes, she allegedly told another neighbor that somebody had sprinkled kerosene or gasoline on her before the fire, but that neighbor's credibility was suspect, given testimony that no such conversation occurred, and that after the fire, but before the trial, the two families were engaged in litigation against each other. Yes, a chair had partially obstructed the doorway from the living room into the bedroom, but according to testimony, that chair had been in that same position for a considerable length of time. The ruling went on to state that Christine had no apparent motive to set the fire. No one saw her do it or heard her talk about it, She had not recently purchased an accelerant, and her clothing didn't indicate the presence of an accelerant when tested. The ruling stated that there was at least a reasonable doubt that Christine committed the crime with which she was charged. The court concluded that the post-conviction court clearly erred in denying Christine's petition for post-conviction relief. But the court wasn't done there. There was also that issue of the Brady violation. The appeals court ruled that the state had, in fact, suppressed the complete ATF file, which would have been favorable to the defense. And furthermore, they ruled that had the prosecution disclosed this evidence to the defense at trial, the result of the trial would have been different. So in short, the court said that the evidence used to convict her was outdated, weak, and wrongly withheld from the defense. But even after all of that, Christine still wasn't out of the woods. Do you remember how long it was between the time you got that news and then when you were released?
It was months because the state appealed it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court unanimously denied transfer. And then it was sent back to my trial judge and he went on vacation. So the pro temp judge, when my lawyer started pushing for me to be released, he said he wasn't going to do anything because it wasn't his case. And I would have to wait until the judge returned from his vacation. So the attorneys from the Center on Wrongful Convictions went back to the appellate court and told them what was going on. And then they issued an order to the pro temp judge at Decatur County and told them that they needed to get me out of the prison and either give me a new bond, reinstate the original bond that I had that they didn't return to my family, or release me on my own recognizance. And so after that happened, I think it was 2 days later, I was transferred and then ultimately released.
So finally, in August 2012, 17 years, 1 month, and 16 days after her arrest, Christine was finally released. The state had agreed to a $5,000 bail. Christine walked out of prison and into the arms of her mother and her now teenage son, Trent. When you got out of prison, what was the first thing you did, if you remember?
When I walked out, there were all these reporters and people trying to talk to me, and family and friends were there. And I wasn't really comfortable talking to a lot of reporters. I felt like they couldn't be trusted. Mm. I had done several interviews with a reporter named Sandra Chapman and developed some trust with her. So we left the sheriff's station and we went to a park and I did an interview with her. The great thing was I got to take off my shoes and walk through the grass, and my family was there waiting. And when we finished the interview, we went to a restaurant and had a wonderful meal. And then that night, I got to watch my son sleep for the first time.
For the first time in 17 years, Christine had her freedom back. But how free can you really be with the possible retrial looming over you? Not only that, but as Christine tells it, she had no job, no driver's license, no credit score, no bank account, no home, and no clothes. Christine went to go live with her mother and her son Trent, who is now 16 years old, in Columbus, Indiana. In December 2012, 8 days before Christmas, prosecutors dropped all charges against Christine, but they told reporters that the case was still open. And of all the things that are frankly unbelievable to me about Christine's case, there's one more thing that makes it even more tragic. In Indiana, there's no compensation for exonerees, meaning that when they're out of prison, they are completely on their own. According to InnocenceProject.org, there are 30 states in the U.S. that currently offer compensation for exonerees, meaning that 20 of them, including Indiana, do not. And some states offer more than others. In Texas, they compensate the wrongfully convicted $80,000 per year, and an annuity set at that same amount. But perhaps the real shame is that exonerees can actually get less help from the government than people who are guilty and then released. Federal law does not require that the government help exonerees search for jobs or find housing or clothing, but these are all things that guilty parties typically get help with during their post-prison supervision.
I mean, when I walked out without a conviction, I couldn't even get into a reentry program because I didn't have a conviction. So when I went in and said, hey, you know, I just lost 17 years of my life. I need to know, you know, how do I beef up my resume and what are things like today and where do I need to go for looking for jobs and this kind of thing. And they were like, and you don't have a conviction. You don't qualify.
Christine has filed lawsuits, however, but she knows that there's no guarantee that she'll get anything from it.
I have lawsuits pending. Because that report that was used at my trial that said there was some kind of an accelerant found in my son's bedroom, they discovered when they went back in and got a subpoena for the file from the ATF that there was nothing found in my son's bedroom, that an altered report had been used to convict me. So I have lawsuits pending, but I mean, they act like there should be immunity for this man who altered this report, even though he got to take 17 years of my life. And there's no guarantee. You file lawsuits, but very few of them win.
I asked Christine what her life is like now, and the damage that this has done to her life is irreparable.
I'd been out essentially a year, and the transition for my son was very, very hard. We did counseling that first year, and I tried hard to show him what it would have been like if he'd have grown up with me instead of, you know, without. And ultimately, it was too hard for him, and he chose to go back and live with my mom. And I needed to see if I could make it on my own. So I moved to Chicago and left all my family and friends. Got a job at Rivers Casino as a security guard, and from there I moved to Northwestern University, and I was the administrative assistant to the chaplain. Everything has changed, and I mean, I can't go back and recapture. I'm 4 years out, and I have figured out how to work my cell phone and the internet, and, you know, I can navigate, but things are still scary and uncertain. I just now have a credit score. You know, I just now have renter's history. When you come out, those are things that people look at and depend on. I mean, there's no thought of, you know, retirement or if I get sick or if something happens. I'm just trying to make it day by day. And the things that I hoped for and wanted, like, I wanted to go to law school the minute I walked out. I can't afford that. I wanted to have more kids. I think you've stolen that. I mean, I can probably adopt, but I'm scared too much time's passed for me to ever have another baby.
Yet another consequence of Christine's wrongful conviction is that she now has a fear of law enforcement, which is understandable given all that she's been through.
I tense up every time I see them. We walked out of the movie theater the other night, and the very first thing I said to my brother is, why are there cops here in the movie theater? He was like, they're security. No, they're not security. They have police written on the back of their jackets. They're not just security. What are they doing here? And he was like, I don't know, but it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. That makes me very uncomfortable. I'm not saying that all of them are bad, because in my travels, I have met some incredible officers and detectives, people that have went out of their way when they discovered that they did something wrong or that somebody was wrongfully convicted and they tried to make it right. And I give those people their props. But if something happened to me, they would not be my first call.
After talking to Christine, I can only conclude that she is one tough woman. Instead of feeling sorry for herself, which she would have every right to do, she's an advocate, and she's determined to do what she can to help this not happen to anybody else.
In the meantime, I volunteer and I go speak wherever I'm asked to. I was in Wyoming not too long ago to speak on policy for evidence. With my case, there was no restrictions, and we were allowed to bring in a new evidence claim years after. Out there, they have a 2-year time limit. And with advances in science, I mean, you can't really restrict those things. So I hope the more that I talk and share, that will change. Hopefully people will realize that this can happen to virtually anybody. And Juan Rivera and I have started a non-for-profit organization called Just Is for Just Us. And so it's going to be for exonerees, by exonerees. And we're hoping that we can build up a community so that when somebody walks out, if they don't have family and they don't have support, there will be somebody right there to help them, you know, with a place to stay and clothes and hygiene and the essentials you need to live. Because some people walk out after 20 years and there's nobody waiting for them. They have nothing.
When I first read about Christine's story, I knew instantly that I wanted to cover it in this podcast. And one of the main reasons is because I think her story, as sad as it is extremely important for people to hear. I want people to know that wrongful convictions do happen and that they can actually happen to anybody, maybe even you. What advice would you have for anybody who might be a suspect for something that they didn't do? So you spoke to police, you took a lie detector test. Would you do anything differently now?
Yes. I would have never spoken to them. I would have automatically gotten an attorney or asked for one. I would not give a statement. And I go speak at different colleges and different community groups and share my story, and the advice is always the same. If the cops are questioning you, don't talk to them. You get somebody to talk for you.
And that's all for this episode. A very special thank you to Christine Bunch for sharing her story with us. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you like the show, please subscribe and leave me a review. And if you want to discuss this case, or any other case for that matter, please consider joining our Facebook group. I created a link on my site to make it easy to find. Just go to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. And lastly, I want to give an extra special shout out to my Patreon supporters. I'm going to read all of your names at the end of each episode, but this episode, I want to especially thank Janice, Tracy, Scott, Francesca, and Amy. Thank you so much for believing in this podcast. My Patreon supporters enjoy early access to Court Junkie Briefs, and starting next week, I'll be posting all new episodes ad-free on there. I also have some other perks that are in the works that I'll be adding soon. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/courtjunkie, and you can donate as little as $1 a month to this podcast. Thanks, everybody, and until next time.